From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Drone strikes on Saudi refineries have hit the U.S. on two fronts, gasoline prices and geopolitically. We'll look at the potential effect of the strikes on what we pay at the pump, and our political analysts consider whether or how the U.S. should respond to the contention Iran is responsible. We'll also look at the static field of Democratic candidates and what might shift the race. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a great weekend. Did something fun, got some rest and relaxation. Great to have you back with us as we're here every weekday, 10 to noon, for Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Little bit later this hour, the New York Times has amended its account of an alleged indecent exposure by Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Republicans are outraged over what they see as an unsubstantiated claim designed to hurt Kavanaugh's reputation. Seven Democratic candidates are calling for impeachment of the justice. We'll talk about that later this hour. But first, there's been a significant hit to Saudi Arabian oil production in the wake of drone attacks on refining facilities in Saudi Arabia on Saturday. Global oil prices have spiked as a result. The question is, what does it mean for prices at the pump going forward here in Southern California? Joining us to talk about that is the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy, which operates apps and websites giving real-time fuel prices, Patrick DeHaan. Patrick, first of all, this a major disruption in the global supply. I'm seeing it's the biggest decrease in output from Saudi Arabia since the first Gulf War more than two decades ago. What's your sense of the effect this is going to have going forward?
That's right. This is certainly a major shock out of the blue, unexpected from a previously reliable and very stable oil producer in Saudi Arabia. So as a result, of course, oil prices have skyrocketed up 12%, actually now up 13.5% today. And so there will be an impact to gas prices for consumers across California and the country. But perhaps the light at the end of the tunnel is I do not expect that prices will repeat their 2019 high that we saw several months ago. Gas prices will probably end up going up by perhaps 15, maybe even as much as 25 to 30 cents a gallon. But it will be measured in pennies per day. I don't think you'll wake up tomorrow and suddenly see a 20-cent jump. I think perhaps maybe a nickel or a dime would be more likely.
What can you tell us about our gasoline supply here in Southern California? My understanding is that our refineries, despite the fact this is an oil production state, do rely heavily on imported crude.
That's right. Of any region of the country, the West Coast is still the most attached to crude oil from Saudi Arabia. But having said that, as a result of increased U.S. oil production, we're importing the least amount of oil that we have from Saudi Arabia in multiple decades. So while we still get some supply, it is not what it used to be. And that's perhaps a saving grace for motorists that, first of all, we've reduced our dependence on Saudi Arabia, but we are outside the summer driving season as well. So having said all of that, the problem could be much worse, not to say it's not going to be nothing. Motorists still will feel this at the pump in the days ahead. But thankfully, we should not see prices get anywhere near their record levels.
President Trump said that the domestic oil reserve can be tapped if necessary. Would you anticipate that would be necessary?
Well, it may be. I think the challenge there is that, like I said, the West Coast is most reliant still on Saudi Arabian crude oil, but there is no easy route for that oil in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to get from saltwater caverns in Louisiana, where much of the SPR is stored, out to the West Coast. So that becomes the major challenge, is oil cannot easily flow to where it needs to go the most. Having said that, there are options, but it is certainly designed to head off massive increases, the White House signaling it is prepared to offer the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is certainly a move designed to limit how high oil prices may otherwise go.
I mean, the other factor is, we don't know what lays ahead, whether the United States might respond militarily with Iran. We don't know whether there would be additional drone strikes in Saudi Arabia once the refineries are back at capacity. And I wonder, that sort of ongoing uncertainty, how would that factor into prices?
Well, like you mentioned, that is certainly, something that the market is not focused on, but that could very quickly continue to escalate the rise in the price of oil. If there is military action, who would that military action target? If this is something that Iran is responsible for, keep in mind, these would be then two major oil-producing nations that could be in a military conflict. And certainly this does not bode well for the future of the price of oil. So there are multiple possibilities here, and no matter what, at this point, the Saudis have indicated that they could perhaps get a significant portion of this lost oil production back in days' time, if not a week. And if it takes much longer than that, the concern is that this would be a longer and perhaps more profound impact on gas prices than what I've currently explained to you.
Patrick, anything else to add before we let you go?
Well, all in all, I don't think motorists need to be in a panic. Unfortunately, yes, prices will go up. The problem would be much worse, though, if everyone went and rushed to fill up. We will see a price increase, but this is not going to be as sizable as what some Southern Californians have seen with refinery shutdowns in the past few years. So this will probably not be rise quite to that critical level.
That's some solace, but those were pretty big hikes. So, but good to keep in mind. Patrick DeHaan, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
He's head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy, which operates websites and apps to give real-time fuel prices at gas stations across the U.S. To talk with us about the geopolitical issues raised by the drone attacks in Saudi Arabia is the Atlantic Council's Director for Middle East Regional Security, Kirsten Fonterose. Ms. Fonterose, thank you very much for being with us. First of all, your thoughts about the claims coming both out of Saudi Arabia and the U.S. that Iran is directly responsible for the drone attacks.
Thanks for having me. I don't think there's any question that Iran is responsible for the drone attacks. We know that Iran has armed and equipped several of their proxies operating in Syria, Iraq, Yemen with this kind of technology and built indigenous capacity among each of these groups. The bigger question is, did it come from Iran's territory? Was the strike originating in Iran? Because that is the game changer. The proxy war has allowed all of the great powers to kind of sit back and play this out on a board game board without launching into an all-out war. And that's where all parties, as far as I'm assessing, still want this to sit. So the Saudis have actually extended the closest thing we're going to get to a goodwill gesture to Iran by saying, we have not independently determined that the attack came from inside Iran. They are trying to give Iran an opportunity to claim plausible deniability there, and that is the biggest goodwill gesture we've seen so far.
So it's a little bit of a pressure relief there.
They're trying, right, because nobody wants a war. The president's statement saying we will decide how we will react based on our conversations with Saudi and where they say this attack is coming from, and then Saudi's follow-on comment saying, though the U.S. has determined they came from within Iran, we have not independently determined that. It's a passing of the hot potato. Iran does not want a war. Saudi does not want a war. The U.S. does not want a war because no one wins. I would say, in terms of who might win, the only winners really are the U.S. oil industry and other non-Saudi-based oil producers who will see a hike in prices. Not that they would ever wish this, but, in terms of the geopolitical players, nobody wins if there's a war.
And I just wonder, let's just, speaking hypothetically here, what would be the motivation for Iran to originate the drone attacks within its borders when it's got the proxy capability through the weapons provision that you've described? It would seem like if it really was verified that it had come from within Iran, that's some sort of provocative intent. And what would that hypothetically be?
Because that is the big question, the only reason I can come up with now would be if they had not passed on the volume of technology to a proxy that was within range. So, you know, Yemen is 1,250 kilometers from Abqaiq, so it depended on what their stores were of drones. And whether they had cruise missiles ready to fly. In terms of the PMF in Iraq, they may not have Iraqi units who are willing to respond to them, because recently their proxies in Iraq were put inside the Iraqi Ministry of Defense, and they tend to answer to a more reasonable Shia cleric, Ali Sistani, who sits inside Iraq. So they may have said, okay, well, these people may not be willing to take this leap. They may not have been able to access another point within Syria that could cut over. You know, it could have been technological limitations, territorial limitations. A ridge is too high to maintain GPS contact with the drone. I mean, if there was a reason that they did it, it would have to be a big risk-reward calculus, because this really ups the game if it did come from inside, which is why most of us think there's got to be another explanation. What it looks like is that most of the impacts on the facility were on the western side, so that would mean not from Iran. So there's still a lot kind of going on in terms of looking at this. Some folks argue that no attack like this could come without long-term planning and lots of coordination and transfer of technologies. But, you know, we've seen big attacks before that, I mean, look at 9/11 for one thing. That had no state sponsor, despite a lot of people at the beginning saying that it did. And if these strikes were all Western impact, then that would mean they could not have come from inside Iran. Nobody has a ballistic missile that does a J-turn at this point.
We're talking with Kirsten Fontarose, who's with the Atlantic Council, the international affairs think tank based in D.C. She directs the Middle East Regional Security Program for the council. We're talking with her about the Saturday events, in which a significant part of Saudi oil production was knocked out through a series of multiple drone attacks at major facilities. And we're looking at where that fits into the geopolitical conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the U.S., of course, sitting back, Russia also looking at this closely. So you have all the different international players observing the impact of this. And Ms. Fontarose, what would be the potential benefit, aside from just, you know, poke in the eye, that Iran is dealing to Saudi Arabia? What would they see as a perhaps more lasting strategic gain coming from the attacks?
Well, this is a big signal that we can reach all of your production. We could potentially shut you down, because this isn't in a vacuum. There was a strike on a pipeline previously, the East-West pipeline, that is one of the major pipelines for transporting Saudi products. You had this morning the seizure of a tanker down off of Fujairah. So what they're saying is, we could envelop you. We could potentially cut off all of your exports, and this is how. And you don't have currently the right kind of defenses to be able to cut this off. So they're intentionally striking targets that are sort of non-sympathetic. They're not causing casualties. So they want to make sure that there's no international community rallying behind a call for a kinetic response. It's rather smart, very strategic on their part. We've known that this facility was vulnerable for years. There was an Al-Qaeda attack, ground-based, with some vehicles. It was not particularly successful in 2006. The U.S. sent over senior members of our Homeland Security staff in 2010 or 11 to look at those vulnerabilities. Because of where this sits on that eastern coast of Saudi, it's kind of a sitting duck. And if you're Saudi, you have Iran or its proxies on three of your borders. So I'm not saying it was inevitable, but, you know, they knew that this was a possibility. And then if you're Iran, you're now looking at the U.S. not having a national security advisor in a seat. You have a brand new minister of energy in Saudi Arabia, a brand new head of the Saudi oil company, Aramco. So it's sort of transitional uncertainty. It's this window of opportunity when they knew that it would take all of those decision makers a while to kind of coalesce a response plan.
I want to thank you so much for describing for us the background of the events over the weekend in the Persian Gulf region, Saudi Arabia, and concerns about Iran's direct or indirect involvement in those attacks. and where the U.S. potentially goes from here. Kirsten Fonte-Rose of the Atlantic Council, the international affairs think tank based in Washington, D.C., and she's held diplomacy roles at the White House for the Departments of Defense and State. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, our weekly political analysis. We have much to talk about, including the strikes in Saudi Arabia. We'll also be talking about a New York Times piece that ran yesterday involving an allegation against Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Good morning. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us for our weekly look at political developments. A little bit later, we'll talk about the 2020 field and how on the Democratic side, there hasn't been a lot of shifting, it seems, even with a series of large numbers of candidates in the debates. We'll talk about some of the reasons why it appears there hasn't been more winnowing of the field. But first, we begin with a New York Times op-ed that ran yesterday. Authors of an upcoming book, The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, an investigation, described several sexual assault allegations against Kavanaugh, including one that had not previously been reported. The New York Times walked back the original piece that ran with additional information that the woman who allegedly was assaulted in the previously unreported case declined to be interviewed, and Yale alums, friends of hers, said that she did not have any recollection of the incident. With us to talk about this in the wake of a number of the Democratic candidates calling for the impeachment of Justice Kavanaugh is Amanda Renteria, who is president of Emerge America, a national organization identifying and training Democratic women to run for political office. Amanda, good to have you with us again. First of all, your thoughts about, I believe it's seven of the candidates calling for impeachment.
Right. So thanks for having me on. You know, as I opened up what happened today or what happened over the last couple of days on the new allegations and really laying out what happened and what didn't happen in the investigation, I think really did, once again, I've seen on my network certainly women around the country sort of saying, we knew it, right? And you saw that in, you know, some of what Senator Gillibrand is saying, what Senator Klobuchar is saying. What you are seeing people recognize is what happened here and how do we figure out what's going on. It's not surprising to me that we are seeing so many people speak out, and I think it's because how quickly that investigation happened during the Senate hearing. And everyone's remembering what that felt like, what it meant, and sort of a feeling of, I knew it. I knew there was more. And so to read it in black and white for any woman out there, it raises the entire Me Too movement again. It raises how seriously women are being taken when they bring these allegations forward. And so it's not surprising to see as many folks come out. We will see how this process continues going forward. But I think a lot of people are talking about it as, you know, impeachment, yes or no, as opposed to this idea, at least from what I'm hearing about women, and I was just in D.C. talking to quite a few of my friends there, is are women listened to? And so this process that I think the country is going on now and our presidential candidates are grappling with is how do we make sure that people are heard and allegations are taken seriously?
And while at the same time not just accepting allegations at face value and looking for corroboration, I mean, I think one of the things that's striking in these cases is that these Professor Blasey Ford's allegation, there have been months for private investigators and people to conduct interviews and talk with people. There, to my knowledge, hasn't been corroboration of her account. We also have in the case of Deborah Ramirez and the new incident that's come to light, there has not been corroboration. Those two were in party settings with other people that were there. And I wonder, are Democrats concerned, Amanda, that, you know, you've got claims in these three incidents where there are real questions about the accounts and a lack of corroboration that this is going to, in fact, lead to greater Republican turnout in the election.
I think what you're seeing is now, as time has moved on, and you've seen that the Senate and the House have really tried to bring in people to corroborate, whether we're talking about some of the things that have happened in the White House, some of the investigations that have happened. I think there's a real concern, and I know I was with Congressman Schiff just a couple of weeks ago, about how much just asking the questions and getting answers, how much that process has been impeded. And so for many Democrats, what I am hearing is we've got to have a fair process. And so what you will hear from folks on the Hill, et cetera, is they'll say, listen, in order to do our jobs as leaders, as legislative leaders, as stewards of what the public gets to see or doesn't get to see or know about or doesn't get to know about, is as much about our relationship with making sure we can get conversations and understand what really happened here. And so for most Democrats at this point, there's a real question as to how are we going to have a process that is fair for the public. And so, you know, we will see as time goes on, but from what I'm hearing about how leaders are feeling, at least on the Hill, that are supposed to be a check and balance, they're not getting the kind of information that they should be getting. So to hear that potentially some of these folks who could have corroborated these allegations weren't even talked to in an investigation, that part is concerning, and actually what a lot of these chairmen, et cetera, have been seeing in the House.
We're talking with Amanda Renteria, also with us, Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. Sean, your thoughts about the political repercussions if Democrats do pursue impeachment of the justice?
Well, I actually believe, and I've said this on your program before, Larry, that the Supreme Court is probably what got Donald Trump elected. There were a lot of kind of mainstream Republicans who really, really had issues with Donald Trump, some of the vulgarity that he had. But when Ruth Bader Ginsburg came out and started talking about the court, a lot of them came in line and said, you know, it's too important. There are too many other issues. So they pressed the lever for Donald Trump. I do believe that the fact that this is being brought back up now, it's following on Deborah Katz's statement in front of the legal theory conference in Baltimore saying that it was about Roe v. Wade.
The attorney for Professor Blasey Ford.
Yes. That this is going to motivate other Republicans to come in line with Mr. Trump. And the other thing, too, I think the New York Times is getting a huge black eye. You've got not only their editor's notes, President Trump's calling a retraction, the New York Times is calling editor's note, but Dean Piquet has stumbled all over himself. He's the editor from the New York Times, you know, stepping into things where headlines are going on, where people in the newsroom say it is our job to attack Donald Trump. So I just think this all gets rolled into presidential politics, and I think, in a weird sort of way, it's probably going to benefit President Trump.
What about, though, the argument that the FBI didn't fully investigate the allegations, that there were potentially people who could corroborate the allegations against the justice who weren't talked to? There wasn't a chance for the Senate Judiciary Committee to get a full airing of that. What about that argument that's embedded in this new book and in the piece excerpted, or I should say, that spun off from the book in The Times?
Yeah, so Larry, just to understand how the process works, it's not just the FBI going out and interviewing people. You've got staff members on the Senate Judiciary Committee, both on the Republican side and the Democrat side, and they do the lion's share of the interviewing and the lion's share of the work. And this information, from what I understand, was put forward. The Democratic staff people did not jump on this. They did not decide to call Max in and have him testify in front of the Senate. And that probably has to do with the fact that the individual does not recall the event happening and didn't want to be interviewed and didn't want to discuss it. So, look, you know, this is still the United States Senate. It's not a Kafka-esque trial that we have going on here. And I just don't think that even the liberal Democratic staff members, including one of the candidates who's come out and talked about this, felt comfortable bringing Max forward because there was no there with regards to what he presented.
Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, Amanda Renteria of Emerge America with us. Sean, what about the president's tweet that the Justice Department should rescue Justice Kavanaugh? How do you interpret that?
I don't know what the heck he's talking about. Look, so let's put a few things in context. There's been, I think, 15 or 17 federal judges who've ever gone through impeachment proceedings, and none of them have ever been successful. I think maybe one. The last time there was an impeachment proceeding that happened against a member of the United States Supreme Court was a guy named Samuel Chase that happened in 1804. And the issue that they went after him on was actually politically ideological kind of differences between, you know, Thomas Jefferson and, you know, the Federalists versus Jefferson's party. And the bottom line is, through that whole process, they made a determination that we can't really try people based on politics. And so there are a lot of mud that was thrown up against the wall, but it's been highly, highly, since 200 years, unlikely that people are going to come and put forward impeachment proceedings absent some sort of major crime or misdemeanor. And in this case, I can't see any grounds for a conviction in the Senate, not only on the fact that the numbers favor the Republicans here, but I can't see, I think it's very, very toxic members of the House, controlled by the Democrats, actually put forward impeachment.
Before I let you go, short of impeachment, given that there are now a series of allegations against the justice, doesn't this potentially undermine his stature on the court, and that in some ways make it more difficult for conservatives to get what they want out of the court in that potentially damaged reputation?
I don't think so, Larry. I mean, you know, insofar as it's embarrassing for his wife and embarrassing for his kids and embarrassing for him, this information was brought up. It was part of an ugly chapter in the confirmation process. And I only think this is going to embolden Mitch McConnell, and it's going to embolden Donald Trump to make sure that they put somebody forward that is probably, more conservative and less kind of moderate the next time there's an opening. So if Ms. Ginsburg, who's now had, cancer again, succumbs to that cancer in the next, year.
Let's hope.
I think Donald Trump put somebody forward, and it's probably somebody that the, moderate Democrats and liberal Democrats are really not going to like.
Regardless of what you think of her judicial decisions or politics, she is a force of nature, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and we wish her good health. Sean, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
You bet, Larry. Thank you.
Republican political analyst Sean Walsh. Amanda Renteria, I want to ask you the same question about potentially reputationally, does this damage Kavanaugh, even if it doesn't go to a formal impeachment proceeding?
I'd like to think that anyone that has had some allegations and needs to work through them, that there should be something there. And certainly the way he behaved at the testimony, I was reminded of it when Senator Klobuchar remarked about that he had to apologize to her by the way he treated her. You'd think that kind of thing sticks over time, but I haven't seen that happen. Frankly, they're pretty removed generally, but I do think we're in a new age of politics, and people are actually viewing the Supreme Court in a different way. And so I sort of say it's a wait and see how this will affect them and how this will affect the court at large. What I do think, though, is as President Trump thinks about if something were to happen and he needs to put someone forward, I do think you will have Senate Republicans, particularly your women, take a much deeper look and ask a lot more questions at the very beginning to the administration, and a lot of those back-and-forth conversations that happen even before a hearing. And so for that reason, a lot of the discussions that are happening now and really questioning how the investigation happened once they heard about these allegations is an important grounding for every single time a new nominee comes up.
We're talking with Amanda Renteria of Emerge America. She's president of the organization which identifies and trains Democratic women to run for political office. She was national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign and has served as a staffer for Senators Dianne Feinstein and Debbie Stabenow of Michigan. We're going to continue our conversation with Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution at Stanford. Amanda will continue with us as well, but first time for a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, our weekly political roundup, talking about the top politics stories with Amanda Renteria, who's president of Emerge America, and also with us, Lonnie Chen, Stanford University Hoover Institution Research Fellow. He advised Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign and also was policy director for the Romney 2012 presidential campaign. Good to have you both on as we continue here talking about the biggest political stories of the week. I did want to ask you about U.S. response to the drone strikes on the Saudi oil processing facilities. Lonnie, your thoughts about what the U.S.'s next step should be, if any?
Well, there's a tremendous amount, Larry, that we don't know about what happened. We know the administration has indicated that Iran, or at least has intimated that Iran, is likely the culprit. But I think a presentation of the facts, a presentation of evidence, and by the way, potentially corralling support from European allies to corroborate what happened and perhaps to come alongside us if there is some kind of punitive action to be taken against Iran. These are all important steps that I think have to happen before we jump to the conclusion regarding a counterstrike of some sort or some sort of action that would penalize Iran further. Certainly, there's strong reason to believe that Iran was involved in some really substantial way. But I think it's the administration's job, it's the Congress's job as well, frankly, to get to the bottom of what happened, and a public recitation of what can be given to us in terms of information, I think, would be an important next step.
Amanda Renteria, what do you think is the best way, if any, to respond?
Well, I think the first thing that we need to do is figure out a way to make sure that we don't have words like locked and loaded or impulsive language or anything that's going to add to the instability right now while we don't have answers. One of the biggest concerns is, as you think about the uncertainty right now around the world, whether that's what just happened whether that's just what happened in the Middle East or our trade wars with China or Brexit in the European Union, at some point we have so many things going on around the world that we've got to be extremely careful. The fact that we have a president that does cavalierly write out tweets at this moment, and it is concerning, especially when we know that we don't have a national security advisor in place, that you have quite a few new folks or people who have just turned over that are supposed to be advising this president. What? And so I'd say the first thing is, how do we slow down governing by tweet and governing by impulse? And then how do we start to rebuild true diplomacy around the world so that we can handle not just this matter, but as things are more volatile and unstable around the world, how do we make sure we have good decision-making process and collaboration around the world?
And Amanda, you know, strikes me, President Trump was so critical of President Obama drawing that red line in Syria and then not doing anything in the way of consequences when it was crossed, the use of chemical weapons. And here you have locked and loaded in President Trump's tweet, a term which may not be a definitive red line, but certainly sent that sort of message like, you know, we're prepared if a line is crossed, but potentially nothing will come of it. So it's kind of ironic to do something that's in a similar vein as what President Obama did.
Sure, and that's the scary part is saying these things isn't just puffing out your chest. There's an entire process that actually ends up rolling down into your staff about what are people supposed to do? What does that mean, not just externally, but what does that mean for internally and really managing a staff, intelligence agencies, et cetera, all the entire group it takes to really manage something this delicate so carefully.
Lonnie, what do you take from the president's tweet?
Well, you know, obviously, this is kind of the president's way of conducting foreign policy. We've seen this with respect not just to Iran, but North Korea and other countries that he's had various dealings with. You know, I think it's very important for the United States to send clear signals going forward about how it intends to deal with these kinds of situations. And it is a challenge when there's been certainly some unrest within the domestic situation here in terms of not having a national security advisor, in terms of some of the back and forth in the administration. But I think fundamentally the administration would do well to signal more clearly how they intend to handle situations like this one, because, you know, we're not just talking about oil supply here. That certainly is a side effect. We're talking about a region that is tremendously complicated and has had a lot of conflict that, frankly, the U.S. has been involved in the past, some would argue unnecessarily. And so to not have a clear signal around that, to not have a clear plan to engage our allies, I think these are all things the administration would be well to try and take care of before too long.
Lonnie, I wanted to also ask you about the 2020 Democratic field. We have one additional candidate who's qualified for next month's debate, Tom Steyer out of California, polled well enough to get a poll into to make the field. So now we have 11 at least who will be debating next month. And it just does not appear at this point that there's significant movement among the candidates. Do you think that this is likely to last through to the first caucuses and primaries, or do you anticipate that there would, as maybe the debates as they go further, criteria tightens, you'll get a smaller field?
You know, Larry, I think you've outlined it quite well, which is that we seem to be seeing a tiering within the Democratic primary field, which has become, I think, quite solidified over these last several weeks, where you've got Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden in sort of the top tier. And then you have a second tier that includes some very credible candidates, people like Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, Cory Booker. But there is some real separation that's come into effect there. And I think the thing that will begin to create some conflict or create some upheaval within that tiering will be when and if the candidates directly engage one another. For example, Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden going directly after one another, which we did not see in the last debate. If Sanders and Warren, for example, ever decide to go directly at each other, I think that will create a different kind of dynamic. But for now, it's tough to see a whole lot of anything altering the trajectory of the race unless there is some really significant altering event. But to date, Joe Biden's gaffes, for example, have not really seemed to hurt him. The dynamic of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders continuing to push to the far left with policies that are completely unrealistic don't seem to have hurt them yet either. So at some point, we're going to see how this is all going to play. But for now, at least, your assessment, which is that you've got a top three and then sort of a tier of everybody else, I think that's certainly the right way to look at the race.
Amanda, do you see anything likely to shift in a major way there?
I don't see anything shifting between now and the next debate, especially because there's an added candidate now who will be on stage. But it's tough. When you've got 10 folks on the stage, you really don't even have that kind of time to go back and forth. And the group dynamics as they are really doesn't allow for one-on-one with your top-tier candidates. And so far, so long as we have that many folks showing up to our debate and on the debate stage, you just can't get to the real differences between your top candidates.
All right. Also wanted to ask you about California. You know, with Governor Newsom now, we've got significant numbers of progressive pieces of legislation that have come out and in some cases signed by the governor, statewide rent control. You've got SB 5, which creates whole new categories of what have been independent contractors becoming employees and subject to potential unionization. You have environmental regulations that have been passed here in California. And Amanda, I'm curious, you know, you're not here, but what is your sense of California's importance to the progressive movement across the country?
It's incredibly important. Number one, role modeling how things work together, whether it's on the progressive side of the spectrum or the conservative side of the spectrum, the fact that things are moving along is quite different than what you see at the federal level. I do have to say, even across the country, what we have seen, because so many new leaders were won in the state legislatures over 2018, you are seeing a lot more collaborative work happening. And I think some of that is, you know, in the political sphere, because it's not happening at the federal level, it rolls down. No doubt that was a piece of what happened with the auto regulations, is nothing was happening happening in federal government. So how do these industries continue to move forward, especially when you need some guidance and some certainty? You lean on your state legislatures to get that done.
Lonnie, what do you see as California's importance to the progressive movement?
I agree. I think California is extremely important. It's always been a bellwether for progressive politics. I think certainly what we've seen is much more of a collapse, though, of the middle in California over the last 15 or 20 years, a collapse of the middle and a bifurcation of folks, some becoming more progressive and some becoming more conservative, quite frankly. And yet, I think within the progressive movement, there is a lot of whether it's policy development or thinking around the importance of various minority groups and coalitions that have been built in California, there's no question that California is an important piece of the puzzle when it comes to the future of progressive politics.
And the longer term question is, does that lead to a continued middle class flight and those residents and families moving to, you know, places like Southern Nevada, Arizona, Oregon, you know, moving elsewhere because feeling that they're caught class wise between the service worker economy and the very highly skilled, high paid jobs here in California? We'll continue our conversation in just a minute. It's our political roundup here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, we'll take a look at some of those bills passed by the California legislature that have far-reaching impact. Also, our focus will include a look on what the climate change priorities should be for spending. Where should investment go when it comes to climate change? We'll hear different perspectives on that. But right now, we continue on politics with Amanda Renteria, the president of Emerge America, and Lonnie Chen, Hoover Institution fellow at Stanford University. Also wanted to talk about Afghanistan and you know, what the next step is for the United States. President Trump saying there was going to be that secret meeting at Camp David, which then fell apart after there had been a series of bombings carried out by Taliban members. Lonnie, you know, how is this debate likely to crystallize over the U.S. place in Afghanistan?
Well, we're going into this presidential election cycle, and so undoubtedly it's going to become a little bit more political and less about maybe what the actual policy answer is. And I think that it's interesting because what you're seeing in the current dynamic is a lot more of an attack on the president, at least from Democrats, over what it seems to me are matters of style rather than of substance. You know, for example, would it have been right to meet with the Taliban leadership at Camp David, the place where the response to 9/11 was planned? You know, would it be right to engage the Taliban in ongoing talks given what they've done? Would it be right to meet them without certain conditions being met first? These are questions that I think are more matters of style than of substance. And so it'll be interesting to see going forward if the discussion continues to be one about how the president is engaging stylistically in this conversation about the future of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan versus actual policy differences. For example, the retention of a certain number of troops on the ground there, how big that number should be, whether we should be signaling to our adversaries in the region that we intend to withdraw. All of these questions, it seems to me, are subsumed in some ways by the political conversation, which, as I said, has been much more about the president's style than anything else.
Yeah, Amanda, what do you think of that?
I think when we're talking about foreign policy, that style actually is part of policy. Where you meet, heck, how you handshake. I know I've had to do briefings, read through briefings, and every single piece is crafted because it's a message about something. And so that is what you are hearing from Democrats when they talk about the where you meet, how, what conditions you meet upon. All of those pieces aren't just about style and the way he does things, but it is sending a message around the world about how we exercise diplomacy here. And so you are seeing most folks talk about that. And in some ways on the debate stage, you do talk about that because people understand where you sit and how you meet. They might not understand the depths of foreign policy. But here's another reason why you do need the Democratic debate stage to shore up and have a couple of fewer people on the stage so you can get into the depths of foreign policy. And we have quite a few candidates who have either experience or have been doing foreign policies throughout their career. And I think that's going to be an interesting piece to watch as this presidential debate continues.
Yeah, and more on the domestic economy. This seems to me two big holes that we've had so far in the debates. I don't know what you think, Amanda, but what are the areas where you'd like to see more questions asked in the debates?
You are absolutely right about domestic policy, and particularly around the economy and jobs. I think what we are seeing with the GM and UAW strike today will certainly, if it's continuing, will certainly be a topic in the next debate. But I have been surprised how little of a discussion there has been about the economy and jobs. And that's not great for the Democratic Party, because we do need to be talking about how are you going to help all families make sure that they can put food on the table, send their kids to trade school or college or whatever the case may be. And so I am a little disappointed to not see enough of a discussion around the economy.
Yeah. Lonnie, what areas would you want to see more questions asked to the Democratic candidates?
I think certainly the economy and jobs and, you know, how they plan to deal with those issues. I think, you know, being in California, we're probably a little more sensitive on questions around the regulation of technology. Would love to hear a little bit more about how they plan to handle the perceived rise of big tech and the challenges that creates and presents from a regulatory perspective. And then I do think this U.S.-China relationship, we really can't talk enough about it. And it would be interesting to see how much differentiation there is coming from the Democrats, given that by and large, they have agreed with how the president, at least in posture, has dealt with the Chinese. Certainly, there'll be disagreements on the specific tactical executions around tariffs and when the tariffs are put in effect. But, you know, I'd love to see them, for example, push Joe Biden, who has been in a very different place in China, at least historically. I think it'd be a really interesting issue for people to hear more about.
Lonnie, I also, speaking of tech, you have 49 of the 50 state attorneys general who have filed this case against tech companies claiming anti-competitive monopolistic behavior. Noticeably absent Javier Becerra, California's attorney general. Your thoughts on, I mean, is this just an issue that those companies are based here?
Yeah, I mean, that could be it. It certainly is very suspicious, you know, unless he's able to demonstrate he's got something potentially more aggressive cooking or he's got a different strategy in mind. It'd be interesting to hear that sooner rather than later. But so far, at least, for him to be the only one absent is highly suspicious. That's the only way to put it.
Amanda, what do you think?
You know, I think when you are leading as many different items as the attorney general is right now, it comes in the context of how do you fit this in? Who do you put it on? And what I will say is right now, the California is right in the middle of CCPA, the California Consumer Privacy Act, on implementation. And that takes up quite a bit of your expertise and your staff to do so. But I have a feeling we'll hear more about this from the AG as this case moves itself forward as well. He usually doesn't stay out of things very often.
No, I was going to say, it what makes it so notable is he didn't join or initiate this particular legal action. Thank you both so much for being with us. Lonnie Chen of Stanford's Hoover Institution, where he's research fellow, and Amanda Renteria, president of Emerge America. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Just want to let you know tickets are on sale for our next Film Week screening at the historic Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. It's Saturday night, November 2nd, and we're showing Blade Runner, The Final Cut, on the big screen at the Ace. The film is set in 2019, so as we get close to closing out the year, we'll see it depicted on screen. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk about the array of bills passed by the legislature, either signed by Governor Newsom or pending his signature or veto. And then later on in the hour, we'll take a look at controversy in a Ventura County school district where young kids are going to have a gender diversity curricula. Parents are concerned about it, want the ability to have their kids opt out, which the district says is not planned for. But first, as part of a week-long series here on 89.3, we're joining with hundreds of media outlets globally to provide Covering Climate Now. It's a week-long series, and we begin by focusing on what the priorities should be for spending when it comes to climate change. A New Yorker piece last week, written by novelist Jonathan Franzen, made the argument that human nature essentially being what it is, there was no way that we were going to be able to meet the kinds of limits necessary on CO2 emissions to avert serious climate change, and that we had to prepare for a world that would be dramatically different as a result. That piece was widely criticized, condemned by scientists, but we open up the question, what should be the priority for spending? And we begin with USC, a professor of public policy and economics. He directs SC's Center for Sustainability Solutions, Antonio Bento. Professor Bento, thank you so much for being with us. First of all, your response to Franzen's piece, what did you think?
Well, I think that we have seen essentially two camps when it comes to climate change. Those that perhaps are overly alarmists, and then those that are overly optimists. And what we are trying to do at the USC Center for Sustainability Solutions is actually to foster a dialogue to actually put forward what I would call reasonable solutions. And as we talk about this issue of spending for climate change, we probably should first think about what is the root of the problem of climate change. And I think in a nutshell, partly because I'm an economist, the way I see the problem of climate change comes from the fact that most of the decisions that we do not necessarily account for the emissions that we generate. We are here in Southern California, and I think the most visual example is to consider the issue of driving. So when you and I make our driving decisions in the morning, we essentially pay for the private cost of driving, but we are certainly not paying for the emissions we are generating. And so when we think about funding climate change, the first issue is actually to think about where the funding is coming from. And for the most part, economists that agree that the most sensitive way to move forward is to actually put a price on carbon, whether it's in the form of a carbon tax or a cap and trade program. So I think before we talk about spending, we need to talk about funding. And there's clearly at least an agreement within the economics profession, and in fact, a case put forward by a conservative way of moving forward with climate change that calls for carbon pricing. Now, when it comes to spending, I think we really need to talk about the key sources of greenhouse gas emissions and ask ourselves the following question. Does it make sense for the government to intervene in those areas? So, for example, if we want to zero in emissions from transportation, power, or buildings, what should be the role for government? And I think the conversation should be about the trade-offs that we face when we start putting those spending in place.
Let me step back to a sort of an even more general level. One of the things that I hear from people who are skeptical of big interventions on CO2 emissions is that even if the United States was in and of itself able to significantly cut back on carbon, it would be dwarfed by what happens in the rest of the world. So the argument is you would have a huge economic hit to the standard of living of Americans for what would be minimal or no gain in a global context. How do you respond to that?
So, Larry, with all the respect, I have to say that I fundamentally disagree with that argument. And I think for us to understand the reason why I disagree, we need to ask ourselves, under what conditions would it be in the best interest of a country to act on climate in isolation? And I think this goes back to the way we frame the issue of climate change. The minute we start realizing that climate change is actually affecting our day-to-day lives, whether it's in the form of local air pollution, wildfires or droughts, then there is actually a case for countries to act in isolation. Let's actually suppose, for example, the United States or China decide to be the first movers. Well, these are sufficiently large countries that if other countries that did not act on climate all of a sudden want to sell their goods in our country, what our country could do is actually introduce a carbon border adjustment that essentially levels the countries out. So this idea that we are going to put our economy at risk, it's simply not correct. And in fact, by acting earlier, we could be the innovators.
We're talking with USC professor Antonio Bentu. He directs the Center for Sustainability Solutions at SC. Also with us, director of the Competitive Enterprise Institute's Center for Energy and Environment, Myron Ebel, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a libertarian-minded think tank based in D.C. Mr. Ebel, thank you for being with us. First, where do you think the priority should be economically in addressing climate change?
First, Larry, thanks for having me, for having a skeptical voice on your show. I'm sure I won't be too popular with many of your listeners. I think Mr. Franzen's article saying we're not going to reduce emissions, so we're going to have to get used to the and adapt to climate change. I think he gets the first part right. I think the second part, he listens too much to the alarmists. If you look at the rate of warming, the actual rate of warming compared to what has been predicted, it's much lower, it's much more modest, and the impacts have been mild and so far largely beneficial. And so we don't see trends in severe weather events or droughts. We don't see trends in global food production. In fact, keeps going up, for example, every decade. But I do think that we need to understand that 80% of the world's energy comes from coal, oil, and natural gas, and that's the same as 30 years ago, except that in the 30 years since, the amount of energy the world is using has gone up dramatically. So all these government efforts to reduce emissions are extremely expensive, and they're, in my view, very wrong-headed.
Obviously, the projections are based on computer modeling. There can be differences in those models. But the fundamental premise here, the science behind it, is so strong that CO2 emissions lead to global warming, which then lead to some sort of consequence that is not consequence-free. And you can debate how extensive that is or isn't. But given that at least some of the modeling shows extreme damage done economically and environmentally to the world, would it not make sense to invest in attempting to deal with, if not a worst case, one of the more serious case projections?
Larry, I have two answers here. The first is these projections of damages are not actually large when you look at them. The Fourth National Climate Assessment used the most extreme scenario and came up with $500 billion a year in 2100. Well, the size of our economy in 2100, assuming we don't wreck it with statist policies, is going to be so large that $500 billion is a very small amount. Moreover, the climate models that predict rapid warming have actually been falsified by the data, and yet we continue to talk about them as if they haven't been falsified. Now, the other thing is, What makes a society able to cope with challenges? In my view, what is sustainable is widespread private property ownership and free markets. Government intervention has a long history of not being sustainable and, in fact, of making most problems worse.
But there is an advantage governments have over private industry, and that is that they can plan. And when you've got competitive industries, planning is not necessarily, foremost there. So isn't there a role here for government? Let's take an example of sea level rise, for government to figure out, well, what are the mitigations we're going to have to do as sea level increases for properties along the coast, infrastructure and the like. Professor, you want to comment on that?
Yes, I do. So first of all, this is a very interesting segment because I don't think you could have picked two more distinct speakers. But you know, as an economist by training, I too believe in free markets. For the most part, free markets work, but they often don't work when the actions that you or I do or polluting facilities do cause damage on others. And the fundamental premise is that under those circumstances, the prices that we see emerging in the economy are fundamentally wrong because they do not account for the damage that is being created. In economics, we call that externalities. You don't need to be a Democrat or a Republican to understand the concept. And therefore, unless you put a price on carbon, you're just simply not going to solve the problem. So that's one aspect. So I, too, believe in the idea of private property rights. I do not believe that we are moving towards a supersized government, but I do believe that there is a role for government intervention every time there are market failures in society.
Well, and when you're talking about the price of carbon, isn't that in a sense similar to the sea level rise? Because you're talking about what are potentially greater costs than even now. Yes, I mean you can point to certain things, but it's difficult to say, well, fire season X was distinctly caused by fossil fuel production over the last 20 years.
That's absolutely right. And so I must say that I'm very surprised with these arguments that continue to come forward from libertarians, because actually if we look at the spectrum of politicians, and if we go back to a distinguished statement, James Baker, Secretary of State in a Republican administration, he has actually convened a group of economists to develop a conservative approach to climate change. But of course, that starts with two premises. First, you need to believe that it exists. And then once you believe that it exists, you need to find the most cost-effective way to address it. And that is by putting a price on carbon. Now, you asked us about expenses. I think before we talk about investments, we need to ask ourselves what we would do if indeed we were able to collect revenues by putting a price on carbon. Well, a very simple way to use the revenues is actually to return them to all households in a lump sum fashion. But of course, I think another aspect that is quite interesting is that because of the problems that you were referring to, including sea level rise, including the wildfires that we are witnessing here in California, including the deterioration of air quality in some of our most vulnerable communities, there may be a case for actually using many of these revenues to invest in adaptation programs that actually level out those most vulnerable communities.
What about investing in efforts to try and mitigate increases in temperature? There are technologies that have been at least theoretically proposed that would do that. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's more of a question of timing. In principle, if the technologies are going to be competitive and if the price on carbon is right, eventually they will emerge in the marketplace. So the question then becomes, how fast do we want to act on climate? If indeed there are reasons to subsidize technologies because through learning by doing, their costs drop relatively faster, then indeed there is a case for doing that.
We're talking with USC Professor Antonio Bentu. He's Professor of Public Policy and Economics and directs SC's Center for Sustainability Solutions. Also with us is Myron Ebel, who directs the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the Libertarian Think Tank's, their Center for Energy and Environment. We're going to take a brief break. We'll continue our conversation with our guests and hear what Myron Ebel thinks about the potential of investing in mitigation technologies related to climate change. You can share your questions or comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back momentarily. It's AirTalk on 89.3 KPECC. We're joining with media outlets around the world in covering Climate Now, a week-long special focus highlighting climate change, KPCC, throughout our broadcast day, picking up a variety of different subjects related to climate change. Right now, we're talking about what priorities there should be for funding on climate change. We're talking with Myron Ebell of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in D.C., libertarian-minded think tank. He led President Trump's EPA transition team. And Antonio Bentu, USC professor of public policy and economics. He directs SC's Center for Sustainability Solutions. Myron Ebell, wanted to ask you about what you think of some of these theoretical approaches. If we're not successful in cutting CO2 emissions enough to avoid global warming, other ways that perhaps we could try and manipulate the climate. Do you think any of those are promising enough to pursue?
I'm very hesitant to promote geoengineering or other ways to prevent climate change. It presupposes a lot of human knowledge that we're really godlike and we can manipulate the climate. And first of all, it presupposes the answer to a very difficult question. What is the ideal temperature for the world? And is the ideal temperature, should we set it so that it suits the people in Los Angeles or in Siberia or in Latin America or Africa or Kansas? I don't know. I don't know what the ideal temperature is. I do know that most of the warming since the end of the little, all of the warming since the end of the Little Ice Age in the 19th century has largely been beneficial for the world, but of course, there are places where you could say, well, no, it actually hasn't been beneficial. But I think one measure of human well-being is global food production. Global food production continues to go up as a result of multiple factors. One of them is the greening of the earth caused by higher carbon dioxide levels. It's not the only one, but it's one of them. So that's something that I think most people would see as good, that global food production continues to go up. So, no, I don't want to play God, and I don't think we should want our governments to play God.
So if you are dealing with, in fact, more catastrophic storms, if you're dealing with larger and more acreage of wildfires overall, you're looking at sea level rise threatening certain populations where people would have to be relocated, areas of the U.S. coast just in this country alone that would have to be fortified against sea level rise. I mean, all of this, you'd have to admit, Mr. Ebell, huge economic impacts.
Well, so far we haven't seen any trend, and I think if you look at the UN IPCC reports, we haven't seen any trend in severe weather events. We've actually, in this country, have a declining trend in wildfires. And by the way, I'm from the Intermountain West, and I have direct experience of forest fires. They have nothing to do with climate. They have everything to do with colossal, unbelievable federal mismanagement of our forest resources. So that's sea level rise, yes. Sea levels have been rising on and off since the end of the last ice age, about 13 to 14,000 years ago. In the 20th century, they rose about 8 inches on average. In the 21st century, it looks like the rate could have gone up to as much as 12 inches per century. So we will have to deal with that. I agree. We dealt with it in the 19th century when they went up about 8 inches, in the 20th century about 8 inches, and the 21st century, if it's 12 inches, we'll probably have to deal with that. But
okay.
It's a minor, Holland dealt with sea level rise and drained the salt marshes using pre-modern technology. And at the same time, they became one of the richest countries in the world. So,
Professor Bentu, first of all, the contention that storms, weather patterns have not been changed to this point by rising temperature?
Well, I really don't know where Mr. Abel gets his information from. We must clearly be reading other sources of information, because I think the scientific community unanimously agree that all these events that we are seeing are directly linked with climate change, with rises in temperature. I also want to correct this point related to increases in food production. Well, food production has not increased because of increases in temperature. Food production has increased because we've improved the technologies that we use in food production, for example, through genetically modified crops, by adding resistance to crops, by making actually land more productive.
I do think, though, that's part of Mr. Ebel's argument.
I understand.
Is the technology can mitigate it.
I understand, but part of the counterfactual would be, how much more have food production grown had we actually addressed the climate change problem? And the issue and the point here is that it would have grown much, much more. So the point is just simply incorrect. Actually, the other reality when it comes to impacts of climate change and an impact that that all our listeners probably are noticing here in LA is the rapid deterioration of our air quality. So the reason why Los Angeles has been in violation for the federal ozone standard now pretty much throughout the summer is not because our local regulators have not done everything that they could to reduce the precursors of ozone. It's because the formation of ozone interacts with temperature and with sunlight, and it's well documented in the literature that as warming takes place, so does the rise of ozone emissions. And I think that's basically a scientific fact.
Doesn't have to do with more vehicles on the road, because we do have a lot more cars.
Of course, we do have a lot more cars, but fuel economy, through fuel economy standards, the average efficiency of the cars have improved. I am not saying that the increases in ozone are exclusively a result of temperature. All I'm pointing is that temperature alone has a very important effect on ozone.
All right. I want to thank you both very much for being with us and sharing your diametrically opposite points of views. That's USC Professor Antonio Bentu. He's Professor of Public Policy and Economics and directs SC's Center for Sustainability Solutions. And my thanks to libertarian-minded think tank Competitive Enterprise Institute's Myron Ebel. He directs the Center for Energy and Environment there and led President Trump's EPA transition team. Coming right up, we'll talk about the progressive bills that have been passed and a number of them signed into law in California as it further establishes itself on the leading edge of progressivism here in the U.S. We'll be back momentarily. Last Friday, the state legislature ended its session for the year. And with Governor Gavin Newsom leading the state, we have a series of progressive bills that look more likely to be passed, in some cases have been signed into law as a result. Joining us to talk about it, Cal Matters' Ben Christopher. He's covering state politics for the nonprofit news publication. Ben, good to have you with us.
Good to be on.
So let's talk about a number of these bills, including rent control statewide that's been passed, signed into law by Governor Newsom. Just a number where the governor, you know, clearly planted a flag saying California is going to be a national leader. Overall, is the legislature feeling as though sort of, you know, the dam is broken with Jerry Brown gone and Gavin Newsom now as governor?
Well, that could very well be. I mean, certainly that is an example of an issue where the story of this bill, AB 1482, was that it had been gradually sort of weakened through the legislative process over the course of the year. And then towards the end of the session, Governor Newsom came in and said, no, actually, I think I'd like this to be stronger. And so that provided the momentum to bring what we end up seeing, which is a rent cap, a limit on how much rents can be increased year over year of 5% plus inflation. So that's probably around 7%. And so I do think lawmakers in Sacramento are getting a sense of how different Gavin Newsom is compared to his predecessor, Jerry Brown, who's often kind of seen as the adult in the room, to use a cliche. when it came to budgetary issues. He's a bit more conservative on those issues. And, you know, over the course of the coming weeks, as Governor Newsom decides whether to sign or veto these high-profile pieces of legislation, we'll see how that comparison shakes out, because there are a number of bills that were introduced this time around that were vetoed last time around with the hope that, well, this governor is different.
Also wanted to bring up the gun legislation, because California has been at the forefront of gun control. Were there additional bills from this legislative session?
There really were. There was a massive push at the beginning of the year, a gun violence working group, as they put it, as legislators put it. I think there was something like 20 lawmakers came together and put together this massive package of bills. And it looks like many of them are going to the governor's desk. So some of the most high profile ones, a red flag law expansion. So the state, since 2014, has had this red flag law on the books, which allows some people to petition a court to have firearms temporarily removed from someone if a judge believes that they're a threat to themselves or to others. And so under the current law, only law enforcement or close family members can make those petitions. And a bill introduced by Assemblyman Phil Ting from San Francisco would expand the number of people who can make those requests, including now coworkers, supervisors, teachers, school staff. And so that's a fairly high-profile example of the direction that the legislature is moving on gun issues. Another bill would rein in so-called ghost guns. So these are firearms that can be milled together from various parts at home if you have the right kind of equipment. And, you know, the concern for years among law enforcement is that these can be made at home and then not be made to carry a serial number. So that's why they're called ghost guns. They're not traceable. And they've been used in a couple of high-profile incidents, including the killing of a California Highway Patrol officer in Riverside this summer. And so a bill was introduced and now passed that restricts the sale of these sort of unfinished gun parts only to licensed firearm dealers. And so that's another example of a fairly big change when it comes to gun policy in California. And,
Yeah, Ben, thank you so much. Appreciate your talking about some of the areas you've specifically covered for Cal Matters. We appreciate Ben Christopher joining us. Also with us from the Orange County Register and Southern California News Group, Martin Wiskel, who's environmental reporter. Martin, thank you for joining us. What did we see in the way of environmental bills passed by the legislature?
Well, there were two big bills that the environmentalists were really looking forward to, and the news doesn't look real good for the environmentalists on those at this point in time. As you and your listeners know, over the past few years, California's been chipping away at the issue of plastic waste, starting first with a ban on most plastic bags being handed out for free by grocery stores, and more recently, restrictions on plastic straws. There were two identical measures coming out of the Assembly and the Senate that tried to take a much broader swipe at plastics. They would have required the reduction and recycling of 75% of all single-use plastics by 2030, and required that all single-use packaging and products be either recyclable or compostable. And even though both chambers passed identical version of this, it failed to come to a vote by the Friday deadline. Well, actually, they extended it to like 3 o'clock in the morning. We'll likely see that again next year, but I think it also shows the influence that the beverage manufacturers and the plastic industry have in Sacramento, that this was unable to come to a vote before the deadline. So that was one of the two big ones. The other one, SB 1, had a strong political current to it. The Trump administration has been criticized by environmentalists for rolling back any number of environmental and public health measures in the last couple of years. SB 1 would take all federal environmental laws that were current as of January 1st, 2017, and make them state law in instances where the Trump administration had rolled them back. The legislature passed this measure late Friday night, but the governor has said that he'll veto it. The opposition, there's a lot of opposition in the Central Valley. They think it will hurt the make it harder to get water to farmers there. And the governor has expressed concern, shared by some others, that this would lock the state into using science that may have been the best science on January 1st, 2017, but may be outdated now. So I think those were two big disappointments for the environmentalists. There were a number of lower profile items that did get passed. So the state continues to move in the direction of environmental protection. But I would have to say there's a lot of disappointment about those two.
All right, Martin, thank you so much for sharing with us about those two major environmental bills. Martin Wiskoll is coastal environmental reporter for the Orange County Register, which is part of the SoCal News Group. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about controversy in a Ventura County school district over gender diversity curriculum, studies that very young students have as part of their education. Parents, some of them are not happy about it and want the ability to keep their kids out of that study session. We'll find out more right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. A Ventura County Public School District is going to be starting next month with curriculum for students K through fifth grade that exposes them to gender diversity. The idea is that this would not only provide important education for young students, but would help help develop acceptance of students who are gender nonconforming. It might help prevent suicide among students in the LGBTQ plus community, help curb bullying and the like. But some parents are concerned about it and want the ability to have their students opt out. Joining us is Superintendent of the Oak Park Unified School District in Ventura County, Tony Knight. Superintendent Knight, thank you for being with us. Can you just briefly describe how this curriculum works?
Sure. Thank you, Larry, for having me on the show. So I'm superintendent of the Oak Park Unified School District, which is a suburban school district in eastern Ventura County. And our program basically is part of our a Character Counts program, which we've had going in our schools for many years, where a counselor comes in and does a monthly lesson in classrooms in the elementary schools on topics like respect, responsibility, cooperation, acceptance, et cetera. So it's part of our overall efforts to create a learning environment where students feel safe and free from judgment and bullying. And many people are not probably aware that we have, like most elementary schools and school districts, have gender nonconforming children at every school, and that more students even then have gender nonconforming family members or friends. So it's important for us to have safe and welcoming schools for every student. And so therefore, we've developed a program and approved it by our school board where gender diversity will be a part of our Character Counts program. It includes a 30 to 45 minute lesson at each grade level, one lesson and delivered by our counselors. And it includes reading an age-appropriate book and then a conversation about the book with the students afterwards.
And you say age-appropriate, so that means each grade it would be customized to how the content would be presented to the students based on their grade level?
That's right. So, you know, in kindergarten, we're using a book that's called It's Okay to Be Different. And then we use another book called Red in the second and the first grade. Other books, Sparkle Boy in the third grade, and a really nice book called Jamie is Jamie in the fourth and the fifth grade.
And so all of these designed so that students are going to be accepting of those differences. Have you had problems with gender nonconforming students being treated poorly on campuses?
We have, and this has been going on for a very long time. I've been in public education for just about 40 years now, and I was an elementary school principal for 13 years. And we had issues come up regularly at that period of time, and I felt, as a principal, very you know, ignorant in terms of how to handle the situation. We would always try to create a safe environment for kids, but since we didn't really know a lot about what we were talking about, it was harder and more challenging to do that. We know so much more now. We have so much more information from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Association of School Psychologists that we're able to employ techniques that will hopefully reduce the level of bullying and the greater acceptance of gender nonconforming children in our schools from a very young age. Since we know that from research that shows that children express their gender generally between the ages of 2 and 7, which of course covers our elementary school children.
We're talking with Tony Knight, who's the superintendent of Ventura County's Oak Park Unified School District, where next month they'll begin the introduction of the gender diversity curriculum. Also with us, Wendy Leung, who's reporter with the Ventura County Star. She's been covering the stories in some of the contentious school board meetings with parents who aren't happy about this being taught. Wendy, what are the parents specifically concerned about, and what are they asking for?
Well, I think a lot of parents have a lot of questions. You know, at last week's parent meeting, there were 300 parents in a relatively small school district that had a lot of questions about what these lesson plans are. You know, gender diversity hasn't been addressed in other schools in the region, so this is all very new to them. Many of the parents that I spoke to just think that this is too young to be talking about the gender spectrum as young as kindergartners. So they had a lot of questions. Some of their concerns were eased, but some parents are still opposed to this. They think that this is something that should be taught at home and not at school.
So they're concerned the way the school would contextualize gender diversity. And my understanding is there is no opt-out provision like there is for sex education?
Correct. The school district cites the state education code that you can't opt out of instruction that's about gender or gender identity. And the parents, they want the very least to be opt out. Now, the school is providing the times of these lesson plans, so the parents could just keep their child from going to school that day. But that would be counted as an absence, and they want the very least to be able to opt out because they don't believe their child should be taking this lesson.
All right. Well, our phones are open for AirTalk listeners. If you have a young elementary school student, be interested to hear if your school has gender diversity as a part of its curriculum, how that's gone, whether some parents have either tried to or actually had their kids opt out of that experience. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll continue our conversation in just 1 minute. Eastern Ventura County School District of Oak Park is introducing gender diversity instruction into its elementary schools, beginning at kindergarten through grade 5. Some parents in the district aren't happy about that. They want it the least, as we just heard from Ventura County Star reporter Wendy Leung, the very least that their students be able to opt out of attending that portion of the school day. I'd be interested hearing from you if your school has any experience with gender diversity curricula, how that's worked or not worked, if it's tweaked that education at all as a result of parental concerns. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us from the Pacific Justice Institute, Senior Staff Attorney Matthew McReynolds. The organization specializes in religious liberties. Mr. McReynolds, thank you for joining us again. Your thoughts about the parents' ability to opt out despite the state regulations. Do you think legally they should have that right?
Well, certainly we do, and we think that there should be a lot more transparency on this. A short time ago, I learned that our organization has been contacted by community members there in Oak Park, and they've run into a lot of obstacles in trying to get information about this as taxpayers in the district who are funding it, notwithstanding what we've heard about the parent information night. So there are concerns about transparency. But on the opt-out question, a lot of activists on this issue seem to want to have it both ways. We just went through a huge debate, the State Board of Education, that I and my colleagues were involved in, where a lot of this type of instruction was presented under the guise of health education and healthy relationships. And health instruction is something that parents absolutely have the right to opt out from under the education code. And so you see efforts on the one hand to try to justify it, say under health education is something we need in schools, and on the other hand, a turnaround to say, well, no, it's really not that when it comes to opting out. So, you know, I think sometimes educators and bureaucrats want to have it both ways, and they just need to give parents more choices and more options and more transparency.
I mean, as Superintendent Tony Knight was saying, though, that they're really in the mandate that came, I assume now as part of the education code for the state, and the mandate for this sort of classroom instruction, that there is no provision for opt-out as there is, say, for sex ed, which would fall under health education. So if the legislature is specifically instructed there's no opt-out here, what legal recourse is there for parents?
Well, there could be a number of options for parents, but my point is this type of instruction, and I've even seen in some of the reporting on this, that the district wants to back away from even calling it instruction, which raises a whole another set of questions as to why spend the time on this if it's not even instructive, if it's not tied to the content standards, and specifically the health education content standards, which is what a lot of this instruction usually is tied to, then why do this? Why spend the time and the energy on it, especially when it's such a controversial subject?
Let's talk with Sarita in Oak Park. I understand you have two teens. You're a parent of Sarita. So your thoughts about the district incorporating this into classroom instruction?
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me on. I am all for it. I think that it's a very intelligent and progressive approach considering the size of the district, especially. I think most of us who live in the community and have children there have seen firsthand already some circumstances where this has been a problem. And I would say it is due to lack of education and information and maybe some old school way of thinking that they have heard somewhere else. I'm very happy that this is coming to our children, and I think it does need to be taken into a sensitive approach, grade specific, like you mentioned earlier, and just like sex education and some of the other incorporated curriculum that we now have. I think it's great, and it's going to help a lot of those non-conforming gender students to stay safe.
And you had one of your teenagers leave the district, is that right?
Yes, one of my children did leave the district. I don't know if it wasn't for non-conforming gender situation per se. I will admit that I think that may have been on the forefront, and I think with a lot of the non-conforming gender individuals, it's not just that they're questioning. I think there's a little nerdiness that comes with it, if you will, if I can use that term very lightly. Some other just trying to find yourself at that age. And so that is something that is very real in an individual at that time.
And so you're saying that kids can be picked on for that?
Well, sure, and especially non-conforming gender kids, I think, have a specific non-mainstream existence, if you will.
Do you think, though, that for parents who are concerned about how this is going to be portrayed, that they should have the right to be able to remove their kids when this is presented?
Yes, I do. Just like any other sex education, and likewise, yes, if you feel like you don't want your child to be subjected to that, then sure, yes.
All right, Sarita.
it would be wise for all of us to start addressing the issues.
Sarita, thank you very much. Appreciate your being with us. Parent of two, at one point, two Oak Park teenagers. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let me go back to Superintendent Tony Knight of the Oak Park Unified School District. Do you have any sense whether other districts are going to be incorporating this kind of a curriculum?
I'm fairly confident that they will be. I've already been contacted by other schools since we began this work, and we're not the first district to do this. San Francisco started it in California and Oakland a long time ago. Another state, Seattle, has a highly comprehensive program that goes much further than ours does. And then 58 school districts in British Columbia, Canada, have started this, and you find it in Australia and New Zealand and other places. So I think that you'll see more of this, and without a doubt, you'll see more. And I think that the state has made it very clear again that, that, for example, the way that we're presenting this program is not under sex education or HIV education. So it's just not that. And I think that's part of the ignorance that exists out there, that somehow, you know, gender expression and conformity to gender and stereotyping is different than sex education. And so this is not sex education, which is one of the reasons that parents don't have a right to opt their kids out. It's about creating an environment that's inclusive for all of our students and welcoming. Oak Park Schools is a place where all of our students are loved and cared for. And this is consistent with what we're trying to offer in our schools.
Matthew McReynolds, just real quickly, what about that argument that this just presenting it's a fact that there are kids who are non-gender conforming and that they need to be treated with respect and not ridiculed? Is there not just basic value in that being presented?
Let's be clear. No kid should be bullied, harassed, teased for any reason. I think we can all agree on that. How we get there can be quite a lot of debate. There are studies that indicate that this kind of approach, that anti-bullying curriculum, if not done right, can actually make the problem worse.
All right.
And there are studies as well that show that the vast majority of kids who have a gender nonconformity or gender confusion will grow out of it unless it's reinforced, the confusion is reinforced to them.
And those studies, I know, are highly controversial as well. We've debated them here. From all of us at AirTalk, have a great day.